Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists come to share their most recent work. My name is Marianne Redden. I'm a postdoc in the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. For this week's episode, I join someone you all know well, Eric, to interview a very special guest. Professor Richard Wilkinson is a professor emeritus of social epidemiology at the University of Nottingham. He's also an author, most recently of the book The Inner Level, and the co-founder of the Equality Trust. In this episode, he shares with us his research on a topic that is extremely important for both psychology and the world today, wealth inequality. So without further ado, here's our conversation.
All right. Today, we are very honored to be speaking with Professor Richard Wilkinson about inequality and well-being and why we should care about inequality and why this is such an important topic. Before we talk about all of this, let us just thank you for joining this podcast. We are very, very pleased to have you.
Well, I'm glad to be here, able to do this with you. Thank you.
So maybe a good way to start this off is why inequality? We have political polarization, we have populism, we have so many problems happening right now. Why should we care about inequality?
Well, I think inequality has got a lot to do with the development of the other problems. I think historically, people have often regarded inequality as an ethical or moral problem, but recently it's become clear that society just works much less well with a lot of inequality. A whole range of health and social problems get worse in more unequal societies, and not just a little bit worse, but a lot worse. Nor the effects confined just to the poor. The effects of inequality are biggest amongst the poor, but even amongst fairly well-off people with reasonable jobs and education and so on, you see damage of inequality in terms of poorer educational outcomes for their children, or shorter lives, or more violence. A whole range of problems of that kind get worse throughout society in more where there's more inequality.
What are some of the psychological variables that explain this effect? So how do we get from inequality to violence, for example? How does trust play into this? What is the psychology in between that is happening here that explains these effects?
Well, it's taken me about 45 years to feel that I do understand it, but I do now. I think bigger income differences or wealth differences, if we had better data, but I think really we're talking about bigger material differences between people, increases the importance of class and status. Those things become more powerful influences on our lives. And you see that in a number of ways, that people are less likely to, in more unequal societies, to marry people from other classes. There is less social mobility, movement up and down the social hierarchy, more residential segregation, and all the problems with what we call social gradients, things like education and health that are worst at the bottom of society, get worse with greater inequality amongst the whole society. And I think what the increased importance of class and status does is it undermines or increases, perhaps I should say, it increases our worries about how we are seen and judged. There's a rather nice paper looking at the status anxieties, I think they call it, your worries about how others see and judge you. And it's clear that it's not just the poor who succumb more to those anxieties where there's more inequality, but all income groups. You know, the paper looks at all income groups from the poorest tenth of the population to the richest tenth of the population. And everyone feels more of this status anxiety. And I think that increases our, what you get is an increased worry about your self-worth. It increases the belief that some people are worth much more than others. It increases the tendency for some people to feel superior and others feel inferior. And I think with it, the idea that the social hierarchy is a hierarchy of meritocracy and often views that it's based on genetic differences in intelligence and things like that. And so with that, as we become more worried about how we're seen and judged, we try and put on a good show. So people spend more money on status goods, more money on a smart car or clothes with designer labels. Money becomes more important because it's, in a way, what you use to show your worth to others. We argue that there are two quite different responses to this increased status anxiety. One is that you simply feel inferior. You're overcome by feelings of low self-worth, lack of confidence, low self-esteem, and you start to find social interaction more stressful. So instead of feeling confident talking to other people, you tend to withdraw from social relationships. You don't feel confident enough to go out in the evenings or to mix socially. I think that leads to social isolation and depression, as I say, accompanied by feelings of low self-worth. But you also get the opposite response. You know, if I'm worried about what people think of me, I might not just accept my inferiority. I might all the time be trying to make people think I'm a clever, successful person, and so flaunting my or exaggerating my achievements and so on. So it leads to both those rather opposite responses, and we find both of them more commonly in more unequal societies. People bigging themselves up and people feeling that low sense of self-worth.
Do you think status anxiety could explain or contribute to excessive hoarding of resources at the top? With extreme income inequality now, we have, you know, like a select few billionaires that are holding on to most of the world's money, and they find ways to kind of justify that. Even, like, you know, some people are provocative online about it.
I think that the status competition does go all the way to the top. I remember reading interviews that a journalist did with some of these super rich people, bankers and so on, in the City of London. And she asked them, why, what's the point of having all this money? You can't spend it all, can you?
Yeah.
And the reply was, no, but it shows I'm better than the next man.
Yeah.
Robert Frank at Cornell, a very creative economist, has talked about that sort of competitive consumption going all the way up. And I think it can be very powerful. I think the people at the top are probably the most driven. You know, perhaps the people who feel most strongly that they really need to prove themselves. Maybe there's some underlying stronger insecurity there that has to be, which leads to that kind of behavior. And I know if I won £1 million somehow, I wouldn't be putting any effort into getting another million.
I have really noticed this. So I am from Germany originally, which is an unequal country, but not as unequal as the UK, the US. And I'm living in California in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is one of the richest, wealthiest places in the country. And exorbitantly expensive to live here. And yet some people live in mansions and I would call them castles with their own towers. And it's just it's a lot of conspicuous consumption, as we've been talking about. And it's very interesting to see what stories you come up with to explain this, because my first intuition when I came here is like, oh, this is just what they value. These are their personal values. You know, in America, people value hard work and showing off and all these different things. And you know, this is like all the YouTube videos that are like, become your true self by working 100 hours a week and all these really motivational, pseudo motivational videos. But this is all still, you know, somewhat blaming the individuals and their abstract philosophy for it, as opposed to taking into consideration that the US is much more unequal than Germany, and that sometimes you do have to work a lot just to get by. And it has nothing to do with your personal values and what, you know, motivational YouTube videos you watch.
Yes, I think it leads to a decline in modesty, people being modest about their achievements and abilities rather than, and leads to people flaunting them. And I used to speak in the States quite often, and I remember a number of dinner parties after conferences or whatever, where the conversation would consist of what appeared simply to be a succession of little stories that were funny, but actually each had a subtext. It just happened that this funny incident happened while I was going up to get my prize for such and such. Or it allowed me to, telling this story, to say that it was at this very fine university I attended. Or, you know, things that allow you to bring in something to the conversation that expresses your status.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Part of what you said, Eric, makes me think about like how a lot of those motivational videos are really kind of selling you a lie, right? People in the lower classes have less control over their environment, and they can work maximum hours. And, you know, minimum wage federally in the United States is something like $20,000 a year, you know, which is way below. You know, you can't afford rent in the Bay Area making that.
We have to be careful about saying what you can't afford to live on, because if we're going to deal with climate change, we'll all have to live on a great deal less.
Absolutely. I just mean what rent goes by. I agree.
These things are relative. And in that sense, you're absolutely right.
So maybe that ties into this question I'm trying to form here, because climate change also is a threat to our like controllability of our environment, our self-efficacy in our environment. People in lower classes have like lower perceived self-control. A lot of the research that I do, I look at the transition sometimes from acute to chronic pain. And one of the best predictors of that transition is having like perceiving less control over your environment, perceiving less control over your pain.
I'm sure you as a psychologist know much more about those links than I do. My answer would be general one about how there's more chronic stress associated with poverty. And I imagine that as well as other physiological effects on health, increases sense of pain, and it reduces an immune response if it's chronic stress.
Right.
And makes you more vulnerable to all sorts of diseases. You know, chronic stress looks rather like rapid aging. And I would expect it to lead to greater, to people feeling pain is more severe. I remember when I was in health promotion many decades ago, that people showed in little controlled trials that being better informed about your treatment, if you're going through some medical procedure, led to you doing better. And I suspect that was that it lowered stress. It increased sense of control. And so I think poverty does the opposite of that, probably.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the link here between inequality and health and well-being, in a sense, right? Because, and this is what you're writing about in this chapter that you sent us, there's a strong link that maybe we psychologists aren't always very aware of, right? If we ask people how they are doing, it's always about the situation. It's always about the person and not the situation. It's really, how are you doing? What are you doing right now? What could you be doing, right? Like gratitude journals that you could write. You could do this and you could do that to make yourself happier without really taking into consideration that maybe the situation you are in is making you unhappy. It doesn't have anything to do with you being unable to like produce positive affect, for example, right? You can imagine someone who is working 3 jobs because of the inequality, and this is the only way for them to get by. And then some positive psychologist comes by and it's like, oh, you should be writing a gratitude journal. And of course, that could be helpful. And of course, that could be important and would be important and it might even work. But there's a certain blindness to it where we fail to realize, well, to some extent, it is right to be ungrateful for the situation because it is unfair. And you are in a situation that is different from the situation that other people are in. And so I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to how you would measure well-being and how you write about it in this chapter and the link to inequality.
Well, I think we normally have a much too individualistic view of well-being and a materialistic view of it. When if you look at studies of happiness, measures like health and a range of measures of well-being, nearly always social contacts seem really important. The number of friends, the quality of your relationships, your whether you're involved in community life. And one of the things that's nice about coming at this through health is you actually see the health benefits of better social relations, better social contacts. I think it was Sheldon Cohen at Harvard, who quite some time ago now showed that people with fewer friends were more likely to develop colds from exactly the same measured exposure to infection. He subsequently traced it to the effect of stress on aspects of the immune system. But, you know, the beneficial of health effects of good social relations, of friendship, are at least as important as whether or not you smoke on subsequent survival. And I think one has to understand the insecurities that I was talking about earlier, the worries about how you're seen and judged, as perhaps the most important source of chronic stress in people's lives. And of course, there can be worse stresses, and losing your house or being sent to prison or having a close relative go to prison or something like that, or the breakup of an important relationship. All those things can be worse. But if you're looking at the population as a whole, taking a sort of public health approach, to this, then I think that the most important source of chronic stress in the population as a whole is these worries about how you're seen and judged, that, you know, make people, in the seminars that you have, I bet people are very often hesitant to talk and ask questions and express opinions until they've got to know each other and relax. We're all afraid of making fools of ourselves. And of course, public speaking is regarded as a major stressor. Almost everyone shrinks from it. That, again, is because we're worried about how we may be judged. I don't know whether you know that paper I often quote by Kemeny and I can't remember, two American psychologists who go through a lot of studies in which people are given stressful things to do while having their cortisol responses measured. And what they're interested in reviewing all this experimental evidence, what they want to know is what kind of stressors most reliably push up your cortisol levels. Yes, the authors were Dickerson and Kemeny. And what they find was that the most important stressors are threats to self-esteem and social status, situations when others can judge you negatively. Those are the things that really get to us, even amongst people who say, oh, I wasn't too bothered by whatever I was being asked to do. Yet, you take cortisol levels in saliva or blood sample, and you see a slightly different story, so that you do see it going up more dramatically than other kinds of stress. So I think we underestimate in ordinary life the importance of these social influences and the way in which we judge ourselves constantly in relation to others. And lots of of different academic disciplines are becoming more aware of these social links, whether it's evidence that obesity spreads through social connections, or whether it is that satisfaction with income depends very much on what other people you might compare yourself with are earning. All sorts of things like that show that we have so long overlooked the power of these social comparisons and the depth to which we are social beings.
There is a really interesting argument that you are making, where you distinguish between, we need more research on the science of well-being, because of course we need to understand it better if we want to help people feel better. But then having that knowledge and implementing it is a whole different story, right? So we do know some things about well-being already, and we are not implementing them at a policy level, because all, a lot of countries seem to be concerned with is economic growth. It's not really, the well-being of their citizens. And so to some extent, yes, we need more research, but we also need to implement the research that we have on a national and state level. I was wondering if you could speak to that argument a little bit.
Yeah, I think often research is a smokescreen. I think there's and for governments, if they don't want to take action on a problem, it's very nice to be able to say, well, of course, we'll do something as soon as we really understand what we should be doing, what will make a difference. And so we're funding research. And I think research sometimes acts as a sort of excuse for inaction. And I think the idea that we can't improve well-being because we don't have good measures of it and don't know how to improve it. Even if we had good measures, that wouldn't tell us what policies would improve well-being. So it wouldn't solve the problem. But it also is ignoring the endless failure of our societies and politicians to deal with things we know very well are powerful influences on well-being, like poverty, job insecurity, unemployment, homelessness, all those kinds of things, zero hours contracts, the economic situation of single parents and so on. In the States, the lack of maternity leave, decent maternity leave or whatever. And there are hundreds of ways in which we know how to improve well-being quite dramatically. And the reason we don't do it isn't because we don't understand it. It's because there are vested interests who don't want to do anything about it. And so research on trying to measure well-being, the great danger of that is it sort of spreads the idea that there are other obstacles and stops people recognizing the real political obstacles to improving well-being.
Yeah, that reminds me. I don't know if you saw in the media recently, there was a call, you know, for like $6 billion would help alleviate like world poverty. And Elon Musk was kind of like flaming it on Twitter saying, I will give you $6 billion if you show me the math that this is true. And it's something that really infuriates me because it's people like weaponize like research in this way or something where they're isn't like there's no like real math, like, and if you want to conduct an experiment, you know, someone's going to have to give the $6 billion to test it. So it's kind of like they create these false scenarios that let them kind of come out on top as like seeming smarter and like I really would be, you know, this good guy if the reality of the situation was I could help, right? But they concoct a situation where that reality somehow is not possible. How do you factor in ideology in a lot of this? Like when I think about these sort of really frustrating problems where we know the solution, we know like giving people free healthcare will dramatically increase well-being, right? We've known this like at least as far back as Virchow, right? When he was investigating the typhus epidemic. But we still have not made these changes, even though people claim to really at the political level want to make those changes. And still, we have a massive amount of people who are suffering from this inequality who will agree with those politicians that are against their own interests, right? And that, to me, is the ideological component, where it's like somehow people really believe in things that are against their direct material experience. I don't know what my question is. It's really like, why? What do you make of that?
I put quite a lot of blame on economics.
Yeah.
I think economics is a theory of our social relations, which is wrong. And every society believes its structure is a direct reflection of human nature. And we interpret our society as everyone wanting more, being possessive, avaricious and so on, and economics provides that the sort of higher levels of theory based on that view of humanity. I've already said the ways in which I think we are much more social than that, but even behavioral economics shows how far that is from the truth. Of course, why we want more is because we, in that desire for more, you can show is strengthened by greater inequality. There's now good research showing if you live in a more unequal area, you are more likely to spend money on status goods. You are more likely to borrow money. You're more likely to get into debt and go bankrupt. That rather than being asocial or antisocial, these desires to look good come from intensely social sources.
Yeah.
You know, it's my worry about what you think of me, which makes me want to look better or makes me feel, oh, I can't face these two people. They'll only think I'm stupid or whatever. So I think that economics is a fundamental misunderstanding of our society. And I think that it provides an ideology that seems to fit. And so we believe our human nature is actually quite different from what it is. And of course, people hunter-gathering societies would not have had that kind of view of human nature. And one of the interesting things I think about social anthropology is the extent to which people regard whatever their social organization, social practices are, is simply human nature. And we do it in the most bizarre capitalist market society.
Yeah.
I would blame the media. I would blame vested interests as well for strengthening that ideology, clinging to it.
One thing I see come up a lot, especially when I've shown some of your research as I set up some of my talks on chronic pain, I think one of the first questions I get from people is like, oh, these are a lot of correlations, you know, between inequality and then all these social factors. And they're like, well, how do you know that it's causal? There's really good reasoning of why it would be, but are there good studies that kind of demonstrate that link? What do you point to when you want to demonstrate causality?
All sorts of things. My undergraduate days did courses with Professor Sakal Popper in the philosophy of science. And of course, his great thing was testability, refutability. And this, when I suggested that and showed some evidence that inequality was correlated with poorer health, lower life expectancy, I didn't know that that would be tested within a few months. No, maybe a few years, by people at Harvard and Michigan. And yet they tested it on the 50 states and showed just the same pattern. Mm-hmm. And actually, there are now hundreds of studies testing that relationship around the world. And so it has predictive value. But it's not only that the that basic evidence of a relationship has been tested repeatedly. It's also that theories about mechanisms that explain that association have been tested. I mentioned the paper on status anxiety. That research was done in order to test the theories that we had. When we first wrote the spirit level, by the way, I'd done a series of books before that, but not as successful as the spirit level book. But in the spirit level, to explain these associations, we usually only had sort of social psychology experiments to appeal to. But now there are a number of studies which show the international correlations with the kind of things we were talking about as mechanisms. And it's not just status anxiety, it's also self-enhancement, people bigging themselves up more in more unequal societies, and the stress and mental health links are now much clearer than they were. I initially didn't know what the link was between different problems that became worse with greater inequality, but it then became clear it's the problems which have social gradients more common amongst poorer people. And when I began to think that was the common link, I did a formal test of that, published actually in the American Journal of Public Health, looking at different causes of death, cancers, heart disease, violence, respiratory diseases, and so on. And sure enough, the things that had the stronger social gradients were more closely related to inequality. But quite apart from evidence of that kind that all fits a causal model, of course, people have looked at lag periods. We know that the changes in inequality lead to later changes in health. And well, I there are just so many studies, and people who say, is this causal? Isn't it just correlations? They don't realize how many studies controlling for so many different things, not only poverty and average income, but all individual incomes, educational levels, whether people, more people in one society are married than in another. You know, and I think a lot of the work on causality is really about whether there are other better theories to explain these correlations. And I just don't think there are. I've given many hundreds of talks around the world, mainly in conferences and so on. And people at one stage said it's, there were a few people who said it's race, not income. But there are now papers looking at ethnic divisions in different societies, which often you can get the data from national censuses. And it isn't that. But even insofar as there is a link between racial prejudice, it's really that it's not a separate factor.
Right.
It's that as soon as your anything becomes a marker of low social status, whether it's skin color or religious affiliation in some societies or language group, as soon as that becomes a marker which allows you to look down on those people, stigmatize them, they start to suffer the effects of that we also see in relation to income inequality.
This psychology of inequality really highlights that just fixing the economic inequality might not be enough, right? There's a lot of psychology that we have produced, this, you know, status anxiety, self-enhancement, discrimination against lower groups, groups that we see as inferior, so to say, so make us feel better ourselves, is really a consequence of this, but then might perpetuate the inequality, right? You can imagine, this is very unrealistic, but you could imagine the economic income inequality being fixed overnight in the US, there would still be so much prejudice against people who are seen as inferior, so much psychology that we have built up that wouldn't just magically go away, right? And that would really somewhat perpetuate or maybe even reestablish this inequality.
I think it would reduce. I think that simply having more African Americans better off does reduce prejudice. Mixing, and you know, I think that to understand these issues properly, we have to understand, I often say, monkeys rather than Marx. and some of the most important advances in our understanding of health inequalities, which is what I started working on, come from seeing that the measures we had of occupational class or any other measure of class distinction were not just proxies for the real causes of the health inequalities that lay behind that. You know, we started off thinking actually it must be aspects of the material standard of living differences between classes that give rise to more of this or that disease. But then we began to realize that it wasn't simply the material factors and that the measures we were using of class, they weren't just proxies for the real causes. They were, to a large extent, the real causes. And you see that so clearly with the research people have done on a hierarchy amongst non-human primates. I mean, Robert Sapolsky Carol Shively initially, but now other studies too, and our sensitivity to social hierarchy has those roots. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you see it in very simple ways. One of the strongest, clearest relationships that have been shown so many times around the globe is the relationship between inequality and greater violence as measured by homicide. Mm-hmm. And it's so clear that the reason for that is in those more unequal societies, status becomes more important and we become more sensitive to being looked down on, disrespected. Mm-hmm. And we know that violence is triggered by loss of face, humiliation, and so on. You know, if I can't get you to respect me one way, there's another way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, doing this research over so many years has felt rather like, and I often sort of had a view of myself as a coal miner or mining something else. And you suddenly find a rich seam of whatever it is you're mining, let's say gold. And you follow the seam and it, you know, you find it widens out because, you know, once you've got into how to understand these things, the jigsaw puzzle falls into place. And one of the things in the discussions in Popper's department at the London School of Economics and Philosophy of Science was the way in which a successful research program constantly finds things, things fall into place in that sort of way. Whereas a failing research program, you're having to explain away more and more awkward results. You know, well, this doesn't fit, does it? What are you going to, how are you going to explain that away? Yeah. And, you know, in the long term, I mean, people did criticize Popper and say there are not really crucial experiments, that theories are, good theories are often surrounded by refutations, but the refutations are in a way low-level theories. They come out of surveys or some data collection, and you... So you don't know whether to give up your theory because it doesn't fit this survey evidence or whatever, or say, what on earth's wrong with that theory? What's on earth wrong with that survey? Mm-hmm. What was their response rate like? Was it really a random sample? What was the exact wording of the question they asked? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that way, a good theory is stronger than what appears to often to be the evidence.
Yeah.
And it leads to a reinterpretation of the evidence. And philosophers of science like Paul Feyerabend actually said that what we want in a good theory is that it does change our view of the world in that sort of way. If it fits all the evidence we've got, it doesn't tell us anything different. We just go on in the light of this theory, we see the world in exactly the same way as we always have. Then that theory, you know, it's not very interesting. It doesn't tell us anything very much. But if it leads to us changing our way, the way we see the world, then it's a much more important, interesting theory.
I would love to hear your take on a psychological theory of lay beliefs about inequality, where lay people's beliefs about inequality. So we're not talking about politicians, we're talking about everyday people, everyone who's not a politician. And what some people have found is that people underestimate how much inequality there truly is, at least in the US and likely in other countries, right? Where inequality is really bad, but then people think it is a little bit less bad. And then when you ask them what they want inequality to be, they want it to be even more equal than their already optimistic like estimate, right? And so the idea would be telling them it's so much worse than you already think, even though you think it is bad, might help people really favor more policies in favor of like redistribution of money in the country. Is that your impression, that people underestimate how unequal society is? And if telling them that things are so much worse than they think could be helpful to mobilize some efforts?
I think it's quite clear. People do think that society is much less unequal than it is. But I think people don't assess inequality from any knowledge of data. They probably assess it from those feelings of superiority and inferiority. Those feelings that maybe other people look down on me. The depth to which these things go, I mean, most of us are probably aware of areas in which we go in for a bit of status consumption. We're worried about how we look or whatever. And yet, I think a lot of us also feel that we're not particularly prone to that. But then I realize in my own life, I don't think I've got to have a better kitchen or whatever for social comparison reasons. I start feeling, it's looking pretty shabby. But my ideas of what is shabby and what's acceptable come from the same social comparisons. And you see this also in manipulation of taste. I was talking to someone who said that when she looks at adverts for handbags, I can't remember what American calls handbags, women's handbags.
Your purse?
They always find themselves liking the most expensive ones best, even when they don't know the price. Our taste is subtly manipulated in particular directions over time. funny thing, we were talking about changing our stair carpet. My wife was wanting a narrow runner with painted sides. And that is the more fashionable way of doing things, at least in Britain now. But in my childhood, having a carpet that didn't extend the full width was something you did to save money, because having a little band. And so our taste has been completely reversed. And you see that in so many other ways. I mean, you see it in, how in the 19th century, when workers worked in the fields, they were very suntanned. And so upper classes wanted to be very white. And then when workers started working in factories and hardly seeing sunlight, we all wanted to be suntanned, and again over obesity. It used to be the rich who were obese and the poor were thin, and then that gradually reversed as the poor could afford to eat more. Suddenly, it became essential for an upper class woman to be thin. And Norbert Elias, I think his name is, wrote a book. I think I reference it in our later inner level book, showing the history of these patterns going right back to the Middle Ages, of class differentiation through patterns of taste and aesthetics and so on. Needed to provide class distinction. And if probably if you pronounce a word wrong, you can feel embarrassed about it because it, you know, shows you're not really familiar with that word or whatever. And you can tell who've learnt their language mainly by reading and who learnt their language mainly by being brought up with, you know.
We want to be mindful of your time. And sadly, we are running up against time. So we want to give you a final opportunity to add anything that you want, such as like, you know, where can people get involved? Maybe they are motivated after this conversation to do something about inequality, to do something about climate change. Are there any resources you would recommend?
Yes. Look at inequality.org for an important American campaigning group. I think there are a number of campaigns, and of course it is now part of the campaigns to deal with the climate crisis. And there was an important paper in Nature Communications a few months ago showing the overwhelming proportion of greenhouse gases that actually comes from the world's richest 10%. It's something like the average person in the world's top 10% produces something like 20 times as much carbon as the average person in the world's bottom 50%. And we have to deal with inequality to deal with climate change. I will just mention one thing around that. And we do have to make changes in our economy and society, rather like were made to deal with, to convert to a war economy in the Second World War, in the beginning of the Second World War.
Yes.
And in Britain, the historians of war and social policy said that the government realized that to get public participation in the war effort, they had to make the burden of war seem equally shared. And in order to do that, they introduced rationing. They put taxes on luxuries and subsidies on necessities. They dramatically reduced income differences. And there was, as a result, that sense of pulling together, of national unity. We're all in it together. And even our present queen got married with wedding dress made out of utility materials. And so, you know, that was done not because actually what the few members of the royal family consume themselves makes a difference, but it was done as a communication.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that. And I think our politicians running away from doing things, rationing must have been quite a shock initially, and the huge increases in top tax rates. But if our governments did something really dramatic, we would say, okay, they're taking this seriously. It's not something that's under control. Unfortunately, the idea that 1.5 degrees is okay and we've got another few years in which to get there and there's a carbon budget and we haven't quite used it all up, those are all rather misleading models of a safe level of exposure. There isn't a safe level of exposure with climate change.
Right.
We should be talking about the tens or hundreds of thousands of dying of it and the huge flows of refugees and the wars over water resources that are already happening. And I do think even if governments only could induce themselves to do little things like turn off the streetlights after midnight, that would tell us, okay, they really mean business. They think this is important. At the moment, there's nothing that tells me it really matters. I can go on as before.
Right. Do you have advice then for, especially for psychology researchers, how do we study inequality? People will sometimes collect like some measures of socioeconomic status, but most people don't even. Most people just study, you know, undergraduates usually at, you know, high level institutions that are kind of homogenous in socioeconomic status. Do you have advice on how we can maybe bridge that gap?
As I emphasized, that I think that our sensitivity to status differences comes from our pre-human past, that it really is about access to material resources. But you see in animals, the fact that the strongest gets the lion's share and the subordinates have to wait to hoping there's something left. That leads to, and so we don't fight over everything, to an acknowledgement that you are stronger than me. There's no point in me fighting you for it every time. I'll only get wounded and defeated. So recognition of status differences becomes really important. And so the material differences that we measure it through in my research are basically the background to the recognition of status differences. People sometimes say that surely status, power, and wealth are all different things. But of course, what matters about them is that they go together. Power was the greater physical power of the dominant baboon. Status was the recognition of that amongst other animals. And wealth was the greater access to necessities that gave rise to. And we do see this so deeply ingrained in our culture. I mean, I've been talking about the status differences, but there's we have an alternative social strategy to do with friendship and equality. The religious symbolism of the communion service I think most people who practice it have forgotten what it's about, but it's about the sharing of necessities, bread and wine in biblical terms. But words like companion, I often emphasized, are composed of and pan. Your companions are the people you share bread with, the necessities with. And, you know, we still eat together. If I invite you round to my house, we probably have a meal together. And you would never think of paying for it. You wouldn't give me $20 as you left. We accept the sharing of food. And that is really a part of our psychology. We know how to deal with friendship. But in a different social context, we also know how to deal with dominance and be snobbish and all the rest of it. We take our cues from the social environment, from the scale of inequality or similarity, and it brings out very different behavioral patterns. And of course, the more egalitarian, the friendship and so on, comes from our hunting and gathering past, in which we were, most of the hunting and gathering societies were remarkably egalitarian. So we have both evolutionary psychologies, if you like, dominance from, I think, the pre-human, and the strategies for friendship and sharing and equality from the hunting and gathering human prehistory.
What a powerful way to wrap up this conversation. Thank you so much again for joining the podcast.
Okay, thank you. It was nice to talk to you.